individual card. Any tips on that, guys, or like thoughts on that? I'll take that as a no. I'm Sean Watson.
I'm Nate Burgess.
And I'm Phil DeLuca.
And we are trying to be Commanderin. Here is some music for you.
Mandarin.
Thank you for listening, everybody. We put a spotlight on community issues and...
Is this Robot Sean?
We put a spotlight on community issues, but never ever talk about four banned topics. Religion, politics, yeah right, Hearthstone, and of course, hip-hop. We'd like to remind everybody here to visit, and all the people at home, to visit patreon.com/CommanderinMTG. Don't forget to visit us on YouTube. Hunter Pruitt and Bradford Heron, both super patrons, bring videos often. We have card images and other things in and cool stuff like that. So cheers, gang. This week, we have a wonderful show lined up for you. Expanding the Indeed. Tips for Noobs theme from last episode. We're going to put it into reminders for veterans as well, because I think there's stuff you can get out of this if you've been playing for a while. We're going to look at some of the differences you'll find playing in a friendly meta or paper meta to playing at your LGS. I think you'll find, you'll both agree, guys, that there's a big difference between sitting around a table with people you know and people who are your friends, and sitting down with those four people with their shark-like eyes staring at you across the table, quivering hands as they... pull their Narset decks. I mean their decks out from their bag to play a random game. Big difference.
The tear which drops from their eyes in admiration as they stare at Leovold. The deadly efficiency of Leovold, knowing that there are puzzle boxes lurking in the top 10 cards.
They're excited because the greatest pleasure that you're going to have tonight is the fact that you get to look at their Japanese foil altered art to Ferry's puzzle box.
What's your pleasure, Mr. Cotton?
The box.
That's funny.
Yeah, so we're going to discuss that. It's going to be a themes episode, gang, so don't expect too much card indulgence. But first, we have some news. I'm going to very quickly mention my GoFundMe, which is doing very well.
Yeah.
You guys are all awesome. And my GoFundMe, for if this is your first time hearing about that, is because of life, my divorces and cars getting broken, etc. All my funds to get to GP Las Vegas disappeared. So we're trying to get me to be GoFunded to get to GPLV. And it's going awesome. And if you go into GoFundMe, just Google Sean Watson, spelled W-H-A-T-S-O-N. You will find that on there. So even if you can spare a buck... that would be very happy. And before you say, I already give to Patreon, your Patreon goes into, all of it goes into the running of the show and costs to keep us online and keep us in equipment. So it's not coming out of that pile.
It's true. All of that does go into running the show. I just found out, at least, your car was broken in as well?
No, I had a minor accident that I thought... it was one of those things where I looked at the fender bender I had, thinking that's going to cost like $100 to finish and fix, sorry. $1,200.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, right? And then I've been away at a wedding in Texas for a week. I come back... my fridge freezer's not working. It stopped working whilst I was away. So I had a flooded kitchen and a fridge freezer full of rotten food. And then my sat-nav suddenly died. The ion battery in it flattened too low, wouldn't recharge. So I was just like, I don't believe in God. But I feel that if there is a God, he keeps kicking me in the over and over again.
Which brings us to Amon Khet and its five gods.
Indeed.
So we have a lot of cool spoilers for Amon Khet that we're not going to go into in too much detail. But very briefly, guys, we've seen a couple of the gods now. What do we think?
The blue one's good.
Yeah. The blue one has potential. I think he, as a 3-drop indestructible 5/4 flyer, he's not bad.
Yeah, and you know, he turns on, he can attack and defend when we have 7 or more cards in hand, and that happens a lot, especially in blue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a lot better for our format than the red one, right? Hastoret or whatever her name is, kitty cat.
She's a dog, the red one, isn't she?
Is she?
I'm sure she's the dog god. It's like a jackal head. It's very similar art design to the... I'm just going to check it now while we're talking. It's a very similar art design to the cat.
It's an active dog.
An active dog.
Oh, it's one of my favorite jokes. Did you hear about the agnostic dyslexic insomniac?
No.
He kept losing sleep at night, wondering whether or not he believed in dogs. Yeah, Hazoret the Fervent is a dog god.
So dogs are impulsive and emotional, is what they're saying, and the cats are controlling because that's the white god.
Well... Anubis, the dog god in actual Egyptian mythology, was the god of the underworld. So
yep.
Dogs should be black. But, you know, don't worry about misappropriating mythology too directly. Because, you know, if they did it exactly, it would just be, why bother doing Amon Khet at all? Not just have the planes, the gate watch shift to Earth 5,000 years ago, you know.
Hey, have either of you actually dictated to your telephone the word Amon Khet?
No.
No? What comes out from the predictive text?
I believe that's why the internet started calling it Almond Cat. Because my phone, every time I would say Amon Khet, I'd forget it. You know, referencing in conversation to, you know, in text conversation to folks. It would always type Almond Khet. And it was like... Oh, come on. So I think that I was not alone in that happening.
The cat god is white, by the way, Oketra.
Yes. Yep. The controlling, aloof controlling.
Yes.
Cats.
As we all know.
The cats are in
cats
charge.
Cats are definitely not agents of chaos.
Mine are.
Oh, yeah, yours are. That's right.
I thought your cats were like a malevolent evil force that wants to destroy your life slowly and subtly, Nate.
No, they cuddle too.
So we're going to do full episodes on Amon Khet later on. So the gods are there, and there's those new jewel lands which are unremarkable except they have the words Plains Island on them, so are fetchable, so... People will like them.
It's wonderful. And Krosan Verge and a number of other cards like, Krosan Verge and Sky Shroud Claim can find them too.
If anybody has any excess copies of Fetid Pools, my address is...
Nate and I, last episode, we talked about how we were certain these borders for the new Amon Khet invocations were April Fool's jokes. So how did that turn out?
Hazoret the pervert.
I think, Phil, it's a conspiracy. They heard that you wanted a non-Phyrexian watermarked consecrated sphinx and said, you can have one, buddy, but you're going to not be able to read what it does or is.
Yeah, they're testing my tolerance. Like, how far will I go for a non-watermarked consecrated sphinx? And it turns out they have not found... the line yet. I will still play this consecrated sphinx, but I'm certain it's going to be in the set, just like Avon Mind Sensor.
Well, maybe. Yeah, that does happen with invocations / expeditions / masterpieces.
Well, ordinarily, the only ones in the set are the new ones introduced.
I don't know. The invocations, they are what they are. I think it's a little bit disappointing they've gone off theme of, like, it was all lands, and then it was all artifacts, and now it's just whatever they feel
Well, Mark says the theme is cards that relate to devotion to the gods.
Yeah, there's a difference.
Which is why there are no green cards.
Card type theme and.
Yeah.
And fluff theme, set theme, like flavor theme.
Oh, totally agree. They started, they basically established what looked like a pattern and then broke it.
Yeah, almost immediately. Yeah. I have no problem with the masterpieces. I know some people out there, like particularly people who are into ripping booster boxes, have expressed an opinion, but I've only found that from oh, it's just putting a tax on players and these lottery cards is just pure profiteering. But I've never bought booster packs thinking, oh, I need to buy this to get an expedition land, for example. When I have pulled one, it's been like, oh, sweet.
Yeah. What's funny is Nick Jargrulski, he bought a pack of Kaladesh just to play the Masterpiece lottery. And I forget what he opened, but he opened up a Masterpiece in that pack. He bought one pack at like a Walmart or something. And boom.
Whenever I buy books at Waterstones, I will always top my purchase up to the nearest 10 because they do like a stamp system and it's pretty good. For every £10 you spend, I'll top it up over the nearest 10 by buying a booster pack. And I did two in a row in two separate purchases. The first booster I bought, I got a Jace Rinn's Prodigy when it was still like 70 nice. Bucks. And the next one I bought, I got an Expedition Overgrown Tomb.
So, oh, that's awesome.
There you go. There's my book purchases paid for the next year.
Yeah. My best luck so far is opening a what they call bundle pack now. And I got a Vermcoil Engine.
That's good for you because there's no watermark on it.
No watermark, baby.
Oh, I got the some cards to sign that Mr. Henry Stuckenborg will be sending back to you, Phil. I may or may not have added a Phyrexian watermark onto most of them. We'll see. A few have been customized. So if you win a prize off us and it's got an extra bit of customization, you're one of the lucky ones.
Yep. So a little bit about that. I asked Henry to buy, because I knew he was in town with you. And
yeehaw,
would be seeing
by
you.
The way. Yeehaw.
So I asked him to buy several Deadeye Navigators, including a couple of foil ones, because we're going to be doing giveaways at GP Vegas, and I figured that on the off chance your GoFundMe doesn't work out, we should at least have your signature on those cards, so... Because Nate and I can sign him in Vegas.
I sat in Henry's front room going, I wonder if Phil secretly intended me to take one of these foil Deadeye Navigators home and put it into my collection. I didn't. But I sat going, nah, I shouldn't do that. Speaking of people sending me cards, so a Nick Jaragrulski, he sent me a care package when I was in America, right? He sent me some Girl Scout cookies. And
he
also sent me some cards that I didn't ask for. I wasn't expecting. And he sent me a very nice Ginger Taxius because he knew I didn't own one. And he sent me like a foil Mystic Snake amongst other cool things, which was very kind. But Nick, I know you're listening. I asked for thin mints, not turnabouts. I will find you and kill you. But they were delicious. Thank you, Nick.
I don't know if I should spoil the surprise. I'll do it. I'll spoil it. I have a box of every type of cookie Girl Scouts made this year, and I'm bringing them to Vegas and giving them to you.
Oh, I'm gonna.
So you have to be there at Vegas, because if you're not, then me, Nate Stuckenborg, Mr. Bentelay, probably Ms. Miller, and several other folks, we're just gonna eat all those cookies.
I'll be in Vegas
because they won't last.
I'll be in Vegas.
You better.
Moving on.
Almond Cat. You guys are pre-releasing, right?
I am on night shift, so I will not be. I am on four night shifts in a row over that weekend. So.
Oh, I was just about to buy you a pre-release, by the way. Yeah.
I would love for you to buy me a pre-release. I don't play at the place I used to play because that's now on the other side of the country for me, by the way, Phil.
Oh, yeah, you better tell me. I guess it's, what is it, Yellow Submarines and Cards?
The Hard Day's Night Car. No, it's called the Scythe and Teacup in Liverpool. Anyway, Gamer Cafe. yeah.
The Strawberry Fields Cafe.
If you want to just put $20 onto my GoFundMe, Phil, that would be pleasant.
All right, I'll do that.
That'll be lovely.
That's a better use for it.
The Strawberry Fields Cafe. I've had a haircut on Penny Lane.
Yeah, you said. All right, so you're not pre-releasing, you're working. And instead, I'm going to put $25 on your
GoFundMe.
And we'll include the link to the GoFundMe. Nate, are you going to pre-release?
I don't know. I have to see the rest of the set. Speaking of cats as agents of chaos, one of them stepped on the power switch that powered a few electronics on the other side of the room and turned off a few things. And right now is in a bag of my Legos, so I'll be right back.
Wow. Nate's cats are nuts.
My dog smashed a, I only own one statue, and it smashed the statue, which is ironically of the Egyptian god of death, Anubis, which is a greyhound-type dog. It's like he knew, I'm the god now.
Yeah, he's like, no, this guy's too bad for us. He's too bad for us. We talk about him all the time. He's too bad for us.
Bad PR. This is radical greyhoundism.
Well, I will be pre-releasing free of cats and dogs, except what attempt they make to put their fur all over my body at Alternate Universe in Los Angeles. Actually, down in Echo Park, if anybody knows the neighborhood. So that'll be fun.
Ooh, a little shout out to anyone who plays at the Emerald Tavern Gamer Cafe in Austin, Texas. I was in you. It was lovely. And the food was good. And the people were good. Yes, and I signed some cards for people and stuff. I felt like a real celebrity.
That's awesome. Hey, I forget, does Henry have one of our playmats?
If he does, he didn't ask me to sign it.
Okay, yeah. So you have the only playmat signed by all three of us.
Oh, no,
in
he
the
doesn't,
world.
Because it got returned to sender.
What?
I asked the woman who lives in my old house, just keep it. I'll come around and get it. And she didn't.
Don't you have forwarding mail in the UK? Or do they just basically throw it in a pile and burn it?
They throw it in a pile. Everyone just puts RTS on the package and puts it back in the post. I need a shout out to Ryan G and his brother, who I played with in Austin, by the way, who were lovely, and bought me a whole pile of Perishes to sign, as well as some Ailies. And Ryan is the proud owner now of the world's only Make Zendikar Great Again altered Ailey card with a little red tie and a Make Zendikar Great Again baseball cap.
That's awesome. It sounds like you had a great time in Austin.
Austin's a good place. Yeah, Texas is an interesting place.
Mm-hmm. The Republic of Texas.
Mm. Yeah, nothing is close to anything. Everything is half an hour away, minimum.
Yeah, that's like Los Angeles, except we're only going 2 miles.
Yes. Yeah, the roads were pretty empty.
Yeah, Texas is about the same size as France.
Yeah.
And the rest. I think it's bigger than France.
Didn't you post a picture, a comparison, Nate?
Yeah, but if you slide Texas over, it's about the same size as France.
Yes. So the wedding I went to was a wedding chapel in a place called Justin that all it had was next door to it a shop that sold knives, guns, and discount cowboy boots.
Yeah, you were in Texas.
The shop didn't have a name. It was like a shack that said, we're open, knives, guns, discount cowboy boots.
Yeah, because you go down to the store, you're picking up some stuff.
One of these three items. Because what else would you need?
Hey, let's go down to the store.
Get some boots.
That's the wrong accent. I'm doing more Kentucky.
It's all redneck to me, sir. High Hunter, by the way.
Okay, we believe it or not, we have other magic topics to talk
at
about.
Least they don't all cling to their guns and religion.
Yeah.
At the chapel and gun store.
So, Justin, Texas, I salute you. You were amazing. There was a NASCAR on a big metal spike at the side of the road.
Impaled?
Yep.
It's as a warning to other NASCARs. In actual Magic news, there was a rule change, an actual rule change.
What?
About split cards this week, yeah. You know, split cards are those cards that have the two kind of mini cards on them, and one type of split card has fuse. And now in Almancat, the new split cards are joined by, instead of and, it's joined by two. So the example here is Destined to Lead, and Destined is an instant, one and a black, whatever it doesn't matter. And Lead is a sorcery with the ability Aftermath, which means you can only cast it from your graveyard. And it has its own mana cost, and you can cast it directly from the graveyard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Split cards previously had all sorts of janky mana costs. Like sometimes it was, using Destined to Lead as an example, a 2-mana instant. Other times it was a 4-mana sorcery. And still other times it was like 6 converted mana cost. Well, they've done away with all that now. Now, whenever a split card isn't on the stack, you just add the mana cost together, and that's the converted mana cost. When it is on the stack, it's whatever is being cast. So in Destined to Lead's case, when it's on the stack, if you're casting the Destined part of Destined to Lead, it's a black instant that only costs 2. And when you're casting Lead, which is the green part, that's a sorcery, it has a converted mana cost of 4. And anytime it's not one or the other of those cards, it's a black and green instant sorcery with a converted mana cost of 6.
Seems to make sense, and yes.
Yes. It finally made sense, and as a result of it making sense, has managed to anger many modern players who are taking advantage of the recent cycle of expertises, so that they could basically get, what is it, Baral's that has the 2 mana cost?
Yeah.
Baral's expertise, but then switcheroo, cast Lead in this particular case, if you could cast it that way. Right, they were basically using the lower mana cost to grab it and then casting the higher mana cost for free because that's the way the rule was set up. Yeah, this was the height of rules jankery, and they changed it because it was unintuitive and really only benefited people who dug into the rules.
What a bunch of jankers.
Yes.
I want that on a t-shirt.
So they straightened that out, and of course, as soon as they did, the wailing and gnashing of teeth was incredible, largely coming from people who were saying, I just invested in a modern deck that took advantage of this loophole, and you changed it. You should have changed it when expertise came out.
You play modern.
Yeah, the best comment I read in that thread was, oh, who knew that the price of collectible cards might fluctuate.
Ryan, who I played with at the LGS, who I signed loads of cards for, his brother, who doesn't listen to the show, was there. And he looked at a load of the cards I'd been customizing. And he looked at his brother and said, why is this man written modern on loads of cards? Anyway, hey, Nate.
Mm.
You've written an article for EDHREC.com, haven't you?
I've written a bunch
of them. What's next?
Right now, you're probably reading about Ludovic, the necroalchemist. And next time will be Ikra Shiddiqui, the usurper.
Oh, I have an Ikra deck.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe in an upcoming episode, you and I can slap our decks on the table and compare them.
Oh, yeah. And when's an Ikra Kaideli deck?
Are you going to whip them out first, Nate?
Mm-hmm. Just flop them right down.
Yeah. Jackie Miller, one of our super patrons, is a big fan of Ikra Shiddiqui. So when you guys whip out your Ikra Shiddiqui decks, she's going to love it.
If there was ever a time for a I Like Big Butts and I Cannot Lie parody, Nate, it's that episode.
Yeah, I'm already thinking about that.
Excellent. I could rap.
No, you cannot.
So, yeah, that would be cool to look at. I'll send you a deck list if it's... I think that might already be on deckstats.net, but I will send you one anyway, Nate, to have a play with. So coming soon, watch this space.
And that's our news.
Da, 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 da. News and waffle. I think we should change it because we do waffle a lot in the news. Brings us on to the watch list.
Mm-hmm.
Da, da, da. This week's watch list, breaking from tradition, is not a blue card.
Neither is it technically a watch
list. It is a watch list card. I want you to go back through the time machine. Diddly-doo, diddly-doo, diddly-doo. Little young Sean picking up his blue and black decks for the first time. This card gets slapped on the table and I have a near heart attack at how power creep has sunk into this game. And I came from the Urza's block and I thought this was broken. This card is Terastodon. Nate, take it away.
Terastodon, 6 green creature, elephant. 9/9. That's pretty big. It's pretty expensive, too. What else does it do? When Terastodon enters the battlefield, you may destroy up to 3 target non-creature permanents. You may. You don't have to, but you probably will.
Sometimes it's irresistible.
Each permanent put into a graveyard this way, its controller puts a 3/3 little green elephant creature token onto the battlefield.
Aww.
So you're giving out elephants.
Sharing them.
Yeah, giving too many away, don't you, Phil?
I've been known to.
Yeah, I have a mental blind spot for this card. If you asked me, I would put every piece of money I own on the fact this card has a CMC of 9. It's not, it's 8. But I always just in my head go, it's a 9, isn't it?
Yeah, please. Because of the impact it has, it must be a 9.
Yeah, and it's a 9/9. It's got all the 9s. It's like the Lorthos of green.
Mm-hmm. I still do imagine now that you've put the image in my head, I imagine, Mommy, why are these elephants stomping me in the groin, Mommy? Well, little Sean, it is because they hate you and everything you own.
Mother.
Oh, Mommy.
I went down to the coffers to get some of the money for the cabal put in my hedge fund, and all there was an elephant kicking me in the teeth.
Oh, yes, that is the Terastodon.
Luckily, they're English teeth, so you wouldn't know I've been kicked by an elephant to look at them.
Whenever I play that, I always say, I'm taking you to the Terastodontist. I do. It's goofy. I can't help myself.
So why is this card on the watch list? Well, as I say, this is following on from the theme of Tips for Noobs, which we had last week. And because the third time we tried to record that was the charm, wasn't it, boys? It's not necessarily a legitimate watchlist card, but I remember being a young player, first time I saw this and getting donned, I just remember thinking nothing could be as powerful as this. And this got me thinking, as I've learnt about the format, it's not the Terastodon you fear, it's the flicker engine that it's normally strapped to that you should fear.
Sorry, excuse me a minute, I have to laugh.
Hey, I don't remember who won that game, but I do remember it wasn't you, Phil.
It doesn't matter. I made 15 elephants, buddy.
Let's take him to the zoo, Nate. Take him to the zoo. So what cards did you guys, when you were just getting back into the format or playing, did you see and just say, WTF, what the hell is this thing? Nothing can beat this. This needs to be banned. Why is this not banned?
Mm-hmm.
Nate?
Well, I took a long break when I first started playing Magic. And back then, the biggest creature around was like a crawworm. You know, like a 6/4.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
6/4 for 6.
So then I'm looking at Kozilek Butcher of Truth. For 10 mana, it's a 12/12. Draws you 4 cards, makes your opponent sacrifice 4 things, and it puts your graveyard back into your library. It's like, this card does everything I wanted to do. Let's make it my first commander.
Surely it's really hard to cast, though. It's got like 7 green pips in it or something.
Nope.
Phil, what was the first card you remember going, what the hell, Magic's broken? And then realizing it wasn't.
Well, still, it's kind of broken. The first card I recall having this sense of loathing for it is Glissa the Traitor. Because it was this recur engine that just wouldn't stop, right? And every time a creature dies, you bring an artifact back from your graveyard. My goodness, there is so much abuse potential in that. And it was, and it's, of course, it's first striking Death Touch. And it's like, how do we get rid of this? I mean, we have to wait for instant removal or a board wipe or something like that to get rid of this. And then she's so cheap, you just recast it. Like, come on.
Luckily, though, it's easy to attack into her. She's not got any abilities that make that terrifying.
Yeah, exactly, right? So you can't even attack the person. It's a great defense that says, whoa, 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 whoa. You're not coming over here. And then, of course, you're like, yeah, you're right, I'm not. And it's just... It's just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
Mm.
And I still, you can tell how I feel about that, but I realize now it's not hideously broken like some other cards.
Yeah, it's, this highlights our actual normal watch list, I guess, that everyone has cards that feel, they go, oh my god, that's super broken. But then there are a few champions that keep raising their heads. I'm looking at you, Consecrated Sphinx. And it's about setting personal levels. So if there's a card that you feel you have a massive problem with, like, this should be banned, this is outrageous, but no one else seems to care, perhaps look into why no one else cares and understand how it fits into the game as a whole rather than looking at it as an individual card. Any tips on that, guys, or like thoughts on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, if you see a card that you don't like and it's causing you a little bit of panic, the only option is really to flip the table and storm out after first collecting your valuables.
Yeah, don't flip your own cards onto the floor. Never do that.
Yeah, I know, right. First you scoop, then you flip.
Carefully pick them all up, put them in the box, put the box in your book bag, and then flip the table.
Tidy the dice away. Thank everyone for a good game. Then smash.
You just learn to adapt to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever the problem card is, you find the answer to it, whether it's instant speed removal or something that locks it down. Take advantage of its weaknesses. If it's a creature, it's very vulnerable to all sorts of removal.
Yeah.
That's what I would say. Find a way to remove it and then make sure that goes into all your decks and then remove it.
Mm-hmm. What you're describing there, Phil, is what's called a shifting meta, which mm-hmm. brings me smoothly... as smooth as a baby's
bum,
onto our main topic. The main topic today, the differences and expectations between your paper meta and, of course, your local game store pickup game. I don't know why I've started talking like this.
It's kind of creepy.
Hello, children. Are you sitting comfortably?
Children, go, run, quickly.
I'm here to inspect the smoothness of the baby bums.
This is an opinion piece. And like all opinion pieces, opinions are there to be ignored. If you don't like them, don't be offended. If you don't like something, just move on. And opinions can
Everybody's got an opinion.
Indeed. A lot like a bum hole. English idioms. So don't be offended. Things can change as well. And I personally have changed my opinion on things at least twice in my lifetime. I don't know about you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So in my opinion, there are three main differences that exist between the two types of commonly encountered playgroup, the paper meta and the LGS pickup game. The paper meta, for the purposes of this conversation, will refer to any regular play group that you attend to with the same group of people. So this can be friends, new and old, acquaintances, folks you just like playing with, sometimes even strangers who have been put into a league who have picked up for a regular gaming group. And the paper meta may not even be paper. We, us guys here, we have a good online digital paper, in quotes, meta, don't we, guys?
Yes.
Yes. We are cooperating.
I am a human. Ignore me why I talk human words. The paper meta can even evolve from what the LGS pick up from people you meet your LGS and just start, you know, chatting with. In fact, that's how me and you got speaking, Phil. It was a digital LGS, effectively, but we just got on with each other, didn't we?
Yeah.
And then me and Nate met each other, and, well, for today's topic, LGS obviously stands for Local Gaming Store, but this can mean any group or game where the players don't necessarily know each other and there's no prior expectation or discussion of what you should expect from that game other than we are playing Commandor. The three areas of difference between these two types of play group, in my opinion, are the expectation of power level, house rules, and social contract, also known as the dreaded etiquette of gaming. So power level in games is an interesting thing. First, in my opinion, first, whether you're trying to fit into an already existing meta or create a new one, establishing the power level is a conversation that normally comes up, or rather an expectation of what power level your group is going to play in. One of the most common questions and topics discussed about the format is what is power level, and it's really complicated to ascertain. The game, and by that I mean Wizards of the Coast, don't have a quantifiable power level measurement. They don't say it's over 9,000 or whatever. You just have to read the card and make your own mind up what it is. So you'll hear lots of phrases and terms used to discuss power levels in people's opinions, and that can mean the power level of a whole deck, an archetype of a deck, that's more refers to stuff like modern and vintage, power level of individual commanders, or even individual cards. These are limited to, and Phil, I'd like you to read the quotes after these in the most cartouche bag New York accent that you can do, all right?
Okay.
Okay, so the first one is the tier of the card.
Don't play that tier one, Commander. You'll get hated off the table.
That's New York, all right.
It's the worst accent you could hear in New York.
The psychographic of that card.
Your problem is everyone hates you because you're a spike in a meta of Jennies or Johnnies.
The percentiles of a deck. Trademark Jason Alt.
Nate should read that one.
I hate that guy. He thinks he's so good because he only plays 75%, but you know he has a box full of demonic tutors gathering dust at home.
Thanks, Jerry Lewis. And the last one, controversially, and I'm hearing this one more and more, and we're going to discuss all these points, EDH rec numbers.
I am going to hate every single Marin, Aloro, Atraxa deck I find off the table. And you know there's always one. I personally blame EDH rec.
So, someone other than me, what's your thoughts on people tiering cards? You'll often hear, like, Narset is tier one.
Well, she is tier one.
What does that mean, Nate?
Yeah, you hear that because she is.
I'm Johnny Noob. What does that even mean?
It means that Commander, you gotta keep it off the table or it's gonna win on the next turn.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
So that's easy to define a tier one card. Like, I put out my Merin deck. What tier is that, Nate? Or Phil?
Merin is high tier two.
You're going to win in two turns after you play Merin.
Well, you're basically going to establish control with Merin, and then you're going to win the game.
Okay, so I play Lazav a lot. The amount of different games, I whap him out, and I get some people go, oh, Lazav, oh God, he's like super powerful, high tier. And other people that go, oh yeah, he's fine.
Well, it depends how many good creatures you have in your deck when you're facing Lazav.
That's true. The Boros players tend to get more upset because you know they've got an Avacyn. You know it's sitting in there. I know it's in a lot of wide decks, but Boros players always have Avacyn somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So
they do.
My point is the power level of a commander, everyone has an own individual opinion. I consider Lazav to be like tier 3, I guess, because it really, the commander himself is good, but unless you build the deck to do it, it doesn't do much.
Yeah, he requires a lot of support to make work properly.
And it requires your opponent's cooperation in building their decks to have big creatures that Lazav can be.
Indeed. Yeah. And I think, I will talk about it in a bit, but I think he's quite a 75% commander. Because if your opponents, I've played games with Lazav where my opponents are all playing like token decks, which tend to not have that many creature cards in them.
Right.
And he's just done nothing all game. I've just had to go out for the mill kill. And yeah, it's hard when someone turns around to you and says, "Ugh, you're playing with that tier one commander. And you've put, I don't know, pick someone who's good, but not a Loro on the table." And you're like, "What? It's okay." Or it flips the other way. You've put down a Rafik of the Many, but you know you're playing Knight Tribal. But because he's considered a quote-unquote tier one commander, everyone just destroys you anyway.
Yeah.
Because it's Rafik.
Look, you might build a tier 3 deck around a tier 1 commander, but it really doesn't change that Rafik is one of the most dangerous commanders out there. The same is true of Leovold. Like, one of the guests on our show, Bruce Richard, he plays a Leovold deck that in his friendly, you know, meta, where the social contract is strong, he's not abusing it. He's not running a Teferi's Puzzle Box and so forth. But that doesn't change the fact that Leovold is a tier one commander because of the ease with which his abilities can be abused and just shut the game down for everybody else.
Yeah, I thought about making a Kalia of the Vast with Shadowborn Apostles being 30 cards in the deck, but that doesn't really work.
Exactly, right?
So this comes down to where you're comparing paper metas to LGS pickup games. You're actually better off in your paper meta now because you can build those higher power tiered commanders and have a conversation with your friends saying, "Look, guys, this is just Knight Tribal. It really is just Knight Tribal. Bam, Eldrazi conscription, you're dead." But ignore that last bit.
Yeah, it's Knight Tribal except for the Eldrazi and conscription.
The Sovereigns of Lost Alara, yeah. But that comes down to your own personal playstyle, whether that. So if you are playing it genuinely as a, but in your LGS, it doesn't matter who you're sitting across. If I'm in an LGS and Steve Random sits down in front of me and whips out Rafik, I'm going to go for him because I'm going to expect the worst no matter what he says because I don't know it.
That's right.
So there's a different expectation from the two types of metas.
In fact, Jason Alt calls it the Rafik problem because he says, "Yeah, whatever, we'll kill you, and then we'll look through your deck afterward."
And then go, "Hey, he did have Knight Tribal. Look at that.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah, look at that." So, yeah, learn what the more sort of, the perception of the more broken, in inverted commas, commanders are. And if you're playing with one of them, even if you're playing nice, expect to be treated like you're playing the most dirty tier one version of that deck if you pull that commander out in an LGS that you don't know the players.
Yeah, because strangers can't take the chance that you're being truthful. They've been exposed as strangers to too many people who look at games as an opportunity to deceive everybody they're playing.
Hmm.
And in that particular case, your only rational response is to treat them as if they're running the most dangerous Rafik deck possible, or a Leovold with Teferi's Puzzle Box.
Or if you don't care about fighting Leovold with Teferi's or, you know, Narset infinite turns. If you just don't care about it, then fine, treat it like that. Respond as you would, but always respond as you would to the worst case scenario for that deck. Woo-ha. And if you are the person with that deck, expect that.
Yeah.
I mentioned Johnny's and Jenny's before. Psychographics is a way of establishing the power level of, I guess, of the player.
And what are the psychographics?
And that's what I was going to ask. Nate. Or Phil, what are the psychographics?
Spike wants to win. Timmy or Tammy wants to play big things. And Johnny or Jenny wants to make a lot of combos with these weird interactions of cards that nobody's seen before.
Yeah, and I think in Commander there's room for the Vorthos as well, which is this deck's trying to tell a story. You don't see them very often, but they are out there. Sort of very themed decks around. This is all the crabs. This is pure crabs. And I don't think that fits nicely into any of the other three, so I think there is a fourth. But you'll hear people moan about which of those psychographics the most.
Well, in Commander, you hear most of the moaning about spikes. People will even describe certain metas as a spiky meta, or all the Commander players at that game store are spikes.
I think a lot of tribal decks are considered Vorthos.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Our friends over at Command Zone, they sometimes in their show have said, oh yeah, we play in a... They would use the cutthroat meta, which other people go, oh, well, they're just spikes. But in their paper meta, that's what they like to play, like go for the kill. And they all enjoy playing that. So it's hard to criticize people that want to play that way. The problem comes in a paper meta when you've got five guys or gals, they all want to play as Johnnies and Jennies, apart from one guy that is just cutthroat death spikes. And this is where concepts like degeneracy and, oh, you're just that guy that combos out on turn four and wins the game, problems start to come and start to cause arguments amongst friends.
It's not even that it's difficult to criticize people who play in a meta that may be different from your own, whether it's spiky or less spiky or whatever. It's that you shouldn't criticize those people, right? Because at home, in their quote-unquote paper meta, that's how they all want to play. And they're all having fun doing it. And especially if you're joining a paper meta for the first time, you really need to understand that you're going into a culture that already exists. And if you disrupt that culture, it's going to result in negative feedback to you. So I would never criticize that meta. I would just understand that when I show up for that meta, my Timmy deck is going to get smacked around like a kitten.
Like a baby's bum.
Wait. What? We're not smacking around baby's bums.
No, not since the 80s. We got banned.
Yeah.
And as we refer to paper meta and LGS, when you go to an LGS, I think it's a question this one more. Do you expect everyone sitting around the table to be the most sort of cutthroat spike possible?
Oh, you're asking us directly?
Yeah, I'm asking you directly. Oh. When you sit down at an LGS with four strangers or three strangers or whatever, how do you approach the game in terms of psychographics?
I assume they're spikes. Mm-hmm. The last time I sat down at an LGS to play Commander, it was with strangers and it was between rounds of a pre-release. And, you know, the guy's like, oh, I have this deck. And I forget exactly what the Commander was. And I was like, oh, that'll be fun. Let's see how that works. And then he combos out on turn five. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's great. And it was after tutoring, of course. That just wasn't a fun experience.
Did you play with him again? Did you walk away from the table?
We didn't play again.
So,
and we had another half hour to go between rounds, too. So.
Oh.
Mm. But I was like, this guy, and you know, I shouldn't have done it, but I kind of labeled him. I was like, he's a spike. This is what he does. You know, if you go to an LGS and you're just going to combo out on turn five, then you're just being spiky. I was that spiky once.
I've done that before. So I have played people who are like that, played a game with them and noticed that's what they're like, and then got annoyed, so whipped out. I think it was a Garve deck at the time that had a bunch of infinite loops in it that would combat quickly, and just went, do you know what? I'm going to do it to him. And he got I can't even remember what, he combo looped me out somehow, and it was annoying. So I did it to him, and he got angry at me for doing it. It's like, oh, right. Oh, Triskelion, Machaeus the Unhallowed. It's like, you just did that to me. Go away. Like, live by the sword, die by the sword, I guess. If you're fine with that, doing that to people, you should be fine having it done to you. And I've actually come around a bit on infinite loops and stuff. I've started subscribing to the Josh Lee Kwai philosophy of, we shuffle up and play again. You know what? It just means I get to play another game of Magic.
Mm-hmm.
In your home meta or in your LGS?
So I have three metas. So I've got my digital meta, which is what I consider my real meta. My paper meta, which has gone all kinds of nuts. And LGS meta. LGS meta just is what it is. You know, if someone loops out like that, fine. Great. Well done, you You found the two card loop. You found the Ophidian's Eye to go onto your live visit. GG. Whatever. It's what it is. In my digital matter, we have house rules, which was a topic we'll come onto in a bit. And on our paper matter, we've dropped all the house rules because people just started ignoring them. Literally flower ignoring them. We'd had a no mass land destruction, someone had resolved an Armageddon. And what surprised me was only, like, of the six of us that play regularly, only two of us said, WTF, man. And my response was, no, you can't do that. And the other person that said WTF's response was, well, if he's doing it, I'm going to do it too, and started cramming the deck. And I was like, okay, fine. Well, let's just make it official and drop any house rules around infinite loops, mass land destruction stuff. And actually, we play less Magic in that paper meta than we ever did because everyone says, oh, it's no fun anymore. I'm like, this is what you guys wanted.
Right. Right.
And but it was all behavior that an LGS I'd be fine with, you know. Someone's going to... I always expect there to be an Armageddon around the corner at an LGS.
Well, right, but you're also not expecting to see that person next Thursday night.
Correct. Or if I do see them, I expect not to sit down with them at the same table.
Because you have options. Yeah. Right, at an LGS.
Yeah, or even if I come in, there's only a couple of Commander games going on, and, you know, Steve Mass Land Destruction is sitting there, and I have to sit down with him if I want to play cards, I know it's coming, so I can pick the right decks out, hold the counter spells back, etc., etc. Yeah, but so I've been in a paper meta that people sort of shifting their psychographic from a Johnny to a Spike or ignoring house rules has broken. But that's coming on to a slightly later topic. So percentiles. The percentiles. Trademark Jason Alt. What is a 75% deck, guys?
It's a deck that uses your opponent's cards, like Yaleva. Nephalia's Scourge. That's a 75% deck, right, guys?
It actually is,
can
isn't
be.
It?
Can be. Yeah, that is 75% deck.
It
yeah.
doesn't have... You're not tutoring for
I'm
anything.
Not tutoring for anything. I'm just seeing what comes up.
That's right.
It's probably something good.
Often other people's tutors.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, especially if you're going to be at GP Vegas, you've got to play Nate's Yaleva deck. It's one of those, like, it just starts, and he starts really easy. It's just the, you know, the first four cards off the top of the deck, and you're like, oh, let's see what this is. Oh, it's nothing too bad. Nothing too bad. And then maybe it's a board wipe. And so he does it again, and it's six cards, and he does it again, and it's eight cards, and soon it's just...
And soon you don't have any cards left, because I exiled them all.
75% decks is the concept, and I'm going to word this badly, I'm sure, if Jason Alt's listening. It's the concept that you build your deck, and then as part of the fun social experience that is Commander as a format, you tune it back. So you take out some of the tutoring and the efficiency, and you emphasize more on the singleton format of the deck. And you don't need the bleeding edge of everything. And that will create a fulfilling and worthwhile game experience, not just for yourself, but for everyone at the table.
So, yeah, and if you design your deck to use your opponent's cards, then it scales to the rest of your opponents. So if your opponents yeah. have a deck that's not as good, then your deck won't be as good.
Yeah, so my Dragonlord Silumgar Steel and Clone deck yeah. is my best example of that.
Or Gonti, since it's just using your opponent's cards.
I've played against Stuckenborg's Gonti deck recently. It was beautiful. So beautiful. He stole my Mind's Dilation, and then the player next to him coated that with liquid metal, with liquid metal coating, and then Phyrexia metamorphed the Mind's Dilation.
Ooh,
and it was just like, oh, why does everyone get Phyrexia Mind's Dilation apart from me? And it's my card. Why do people complain about the 75% rule? Because you'll get people moan about it.
Like who?
Like the internet. Jason still gets hate mail about his 75% article.
Go start a subreddit about the 75% rule and see how many insert expletive Jason Alts appear in that article.
Well, because it's, yet another way that people see other people trying to tell them that their way of playing is wrong. Where if you're the type of person who tutors for that Teferi's puzzle box, and then it's Leovold, it's demonic tutor, Leovold, Teferi's puzzle box, you win the game.
You can do it faster than that. Vampiric tutor, yeah, so it's instant speed.
Yeah, vampiric tutor. As long as you have something to cast the Teferi's puzzle box, you know, earlier than your fourth land drop. The basic result is these people are having fun by dominating the game and by controlling the board like that and by making sure that other people can't play it. And it's the same sort of approach as stacks, right? Where you essentially lock everybody out from playing the game and then you win the game by pecking them to death with a 3-3 or whatever. I'm just teasing about that last part. But you're essentially controlling the game and you're playing the game you want to play. And so by saying, you know, by espousing the 75% ethos, Jason is effectively saying, don't tutor for your win conditions. Don't rely on consistency. This is a game about exploration, not about winning. And the people for whom this game is about winning get upset when they're told that they shouldn't be doing it that way. Or at least they get upset when they perceive that they're being told they shouldn't
do
it that way.
Yeah, I think Jason's saying, actually, this is how I play. I find it very fulfilling. Why didn't you give it a go? Rather than saying you aren't allowed or are bad or not great. Now, because Jason's a stand-up comedian and is his own special brand of acerbic when he wants to be, he vocalizes that by like, when I... yeah, he can vocalize that in a very... Force was the wrong word. What's the word I'm looking for?
He was assertive.
Assertive, yeah. Assertive, right. He can vocalize that in a very assertive way, but people find that threatening. But it is just his opinion, like all of this piece. So you'll hear people sometimes talk about the power level of card by a percentage. Oh, I think that card's more 90%. Oh, that card's, you know, it's a bit more than 75%. Like Demonic Tutor is the very definition of a 75% card, isn't it, guys?
Mm-hmm. That will provoke a very assertive response from Jason.
Directly off.
And in truth, I agree with Jason's 75% ethos. There was a time when I was in a meta where you just couldn't afford to believe that if you wanted to even have fun in the game, because everybody else was attempting to lock the board down and make sure you couldn't play Magic unless you were playing Magic their way, which is to sit there collecting cards every turn that you're alive, which is very few. And I have found that by drawing more cards, I'm able to explore what my deck does. Because even back then, I was like, wow, I got to 15% of my deck, I got to 25% of my deck or whatever, and I was looking at the number of cards I saw in my deck, and I was like, there's still so much more to explore. And now by focusing more on card draw as opposed to tutoring in most cases, then I'm exploring. I am seeing what my deck can do. I'm understanding, as Nate said last week, the synergies within my deck a lot better than if I just, you know, Demonic Tutor, Teferi's Puzzle Box, go. So.
Who would have thought 2 years ago that Teferi's Puzzle Box would have been our go-to card for This Is Broken? Thanks.
Well,
Leopold.
I'm just citing it as an
I know,
example.
I know. It's just, it just makes me smile.
It's a totally linear deck, and so you're getting consistency. It is fragile, but you're getting that consistency so that if you can set it up so that, you know, maybe you delay two turns and you have a counter spell to protect it in the one shot that people get to kill it, then, you know, all right.
I'll say that there is a place for that type of deck if everyone at the table is playing that type of deck.
Absolutely.
And everyone expects to try to get their own combo off before everyone else. That's a different level of game than the 75% theory.
It's a different type of game, isn't it? It's kind of like four-player solitaire at that point.
Sometimes.
There is a place for it, right? And I think Nate is perfectly right. If everybody at the table agrees that this is how we're going to play, great!
Oh, yeah.
Excellent. Let's play. But if you're playing in that sort of meta, like I did once, right, and you go out into public to play, and you're then running this, you know, this combo engine that is guaranteed to go off by turn six or seven, what you're going to end up doing is making those people not want to play with you. And if there are new players, then those people might not want to play Commander again.
Yeah, I've seen that myself.
Yeah, you have. You've told that story numerous times.
Yeah, it's, dare I mention the J word.
Sad.
I think my philosophy on that is, obviously, not everyone can afford to do this. If you can afford to have multiple commander decks, have some that are like super cutting edge and some which are a lot more friendly. If you can only afford one commander deck, I personally think the 75%, 80% sort of level is what you should go for.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be able to enjoy your games. If you've just got that one, if you've just got a Machaos the Unhallowed deck and it's full of tutors and one Triskelion, you're not really playing Commander. You're playing, hey, look, I've got Triskelion.
You're racing.
Yeah, you're racing. You're not playing Commander. And yeah, it's different.
But again, if you're surrounded by people who are playing that kind of game, great. I think, and I felt this in my meta, and I think your meta is, you're now recently, you know, unconstrained meta is discovering this too. I think that's a shorter term, that's a kind of a shorter term strategy to approaching gameplay with your buddies. Because if there are no constraints and everybody just races to the, you know, to the whatever the win condition is, sooner or later it's just racing to the win condition and you all have these incredibly sharp decks and it's whoever gets to it first wins. So you might as well kind of roll a die at that point and see, you know, who rolls a six if it's a six-sided die.
Yeah, I think the problem with my paper meta with that one, bringing it back onto the topic, was we started with house rules in place. We never played in an open environment without those things. And several of those people in that group, it was like six of us, three of them had never played Magic at all. So they'd never played sort of off-the-leash Magic. So, and they were the ones that sort of bought in the erosion of the house rules, and now they don't like it, I don't think. Well, they're certainly,
well, yeah,
they certainly have started saying, oh, we don't want to play Magic really anymore, let's play Settlers of Catan or whatever.
I think that's kind of the result of somebody like, let's say, one of us unconstrained against people who haven't been playing Magic as long as we have and maybe hadn't played Magic before they joined the group a year and a half or 2 years ago. Like, we three have a lot more experience than these people do, and so we've seen a lot more. And we can bring that infinite combo to bear. We can bring that unrestricted, like, oh, you want it unconstrained? Well, no holds barred? I know a lot of holds, and we're going to play.
Yep.
If they think they can play on the same field, then what's going to happen is they're just going to keep getting beat up and it's not going to be fun.
And that's exactly what happened. I mean, I built a Breyer deck specifically to combo out and kill people. I didn't even take that to Texas with me because, like, what's the point? I don't want to play Henry and other people with that sort of environment. I want to play with fun. So I took some of my more fun decks.
So Breyer is your demonstration deck that you pull out when someone else destroys all your lands after agreeing not to destroy all your lands.
Oh, if you see my Breyer deck on the table, you've f***ed me off really badly.
Well, somebody has. Wasn't me. It was that guy over there. The guy with the beard.
What did I play against? Oh, so one of our patrons,
the guy with the beard,
Jesse, pulled out a Teferi Archmage of Zelfir deck and like tutored for a knowledge pool and cast it, and it's like, right, none of you get to cast spells anymore. I do. It's like, all right, next game I'm Breyering you. I'll race you for that combo because this deck is full of counter spells and combo pieces and tutors to get the combo pieces and nothing else. Boom. You know, but just say sorry, I don't want to paint Jesse in a bad picture. Jesse did not complain about that at all. He was like, yep, that's fine. You know, and that live by the sword, die by the sword, I think, if you're going to play like that.
Well, yeah, it's fun to go into that, to dip into that pool once in a while, and to have decks ready to go there if you want. But to be there all the time, you're already pushing it to the limit. You have nowhere else to go at that point. Because if you back off, you start losing a lot of games and not having fun because you can no longer deal with the control aspect of setting up that combo. It's funny because that deck that you just described, right, combo pieces with tutors to get them, was my Marath deck. My first Marath deck would reliably go off by turn 6 or 7. And what fun is that? Because I would tutor for the pieces and then I would, and you execute the plan and it just happens. And that's not fun. It was certainly no fun at the table.
Oh, the other day I drew Ivbrea a couple of land, a soul ring, a gilded lotus, a Nim Deathmantle, and a Ashnod's Altar. And I was like, well, look at that.
Done.
I've just drawn the win. I think I had a I think I had a pact of negation or something. It's like, I don't even need to worry about the pacts. I'm keep cost because you're all dead. Yeah. So you're all dead in the untap step, for God's sake. Before that upkeep ever gets get paid. So anyway, that's about percentiles. It's about setting an expectation, and play as you want to play against. So next part on this, this is only a quick one because I've heard this one more recently. And it doesn't necessarily specifically apply to EDH Rec, but any kind of data mining, also people talk about it with deck stats and tappedout.net as well. And this is people, when you play a popular commander, so Meron, Aloro, or Atraxa, start moaning that you've only picked that because that's a powerful commander and your deck is just a net deck off of EDH Rec or tapped out or deck stats. What do you say about that? I guess this is more an accusation of net decking. Oh, you're only doing that because it's popular and you net deck.
Well, if that's what you're doing, then yeah. But
kind of
to
though.
Cite EDH Rec or tapped out or any tool as the cause of that is ridiculous.
Hogwash.
It is easier to net deck because of those tools. And I think but without those tools, people who'll net deck will still go on to forums and stuff and look at what's popular. And ultimately, there's only a limited number of commanders, and the popular ones are going to have certain builds, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like, every Meron deck's going to have probably a Spore Frog in it.
Well, at the very least, what it's going to have are cards that kill themselves or kill the other creatures and then recur them for benefit.
And have good ETBs.
Right. Right. Or exit the battlefield.
And that's a powerful strategy. Is it EDH Rec's fault because they've displayed to you in a clear manner, these are a lot of powerful cards that go into that deck that people find work very well in it? Of all these things we've listed to assess power level, I think this is one I've heard attributed to power level, which I think it's just people moaning about popularity. It's like being at school going, oh, I hate that kid. That kid's a cheerleader and everyone likes her.
Look at it as any individual brewer with any decent imagination and knowledge of card interactions is going to find eventually the optimal solution for a particular commander, depending on what they're looking for. And let's just define optimal in this case as winning as fast as possible, yeah. Right? And because that is ultimately what people are complaining about. It's like, oh, you're just playing that game, you know, that you're just building that deck that's going to win in turn four. And so anybody with a decent imagination and card knowledge and, of course, access to these cards is going to hit the combination eventually that's optimal, and that's it. And what EDH Rec does is just accelerate that process. If you're that type of player, EDH Rec accelerates that because it shows you what the most popular cards are, and then it jumps you ahead many steps and many iterations so that you don't have to go through that initial kind of figuring things out, even if you understand what the card is. You know, you don't have to worry about that exploration. So it accelerates that race to the optimal solution, but it doesn't cause that race. What causes that race is people who want to win as fast as possible and who don't want to put in the time. And frankly, it democratizes it almost by making it easier for the people who don't have the skill in deck brewing to find that optimal solution and to get closer to it. And then through experimentation and play and getting beat up still, because they're probably not the best players, right? I'm going to get a lot of hate mail on this, I know.
That's all right.
Then they are able to approach that optimal solution a lot faster and easier than they were before. But again, that's not EDH Rec's problem. I, for example, use EDH Rec as an example of like how a deck is built. I'll download their, in particular for commanders or colors or strategies I just don't get because I have a green brain, right? I'll download a sample deck and then I'll play it just to see how this deck is supposed to, quote unquote, supposed to operate. And then I tune it to suit my play style. That's how I learned how Muzio was actually a green commander masquerading in disguise, right? Masquerading as a blue commander.
He knows the truth.
And well, you know, it genuinely, I pulled down, I told you guys when we were prepping for that show, I was like, I don't understand this guy. I'm going to pull this. I'm going to play it and see. And it was difficult, but I left the Phyrexian cards in it, but I understood the commander then. And then I made my deck, which was frankly better than the generic deck that EDH can give you.
Yeah. And I think people shouldn't confuse popular and powerful. The two can be the same thing, but they're not always. Aloro is not the most powerful commander. He is the second most popular commander. He might be third now.
Behind Chandler and Atraxa.
Chandler. Yeah. But you'd be hard-pressed to make an argument that Aloro is the third most powerful commander of all time.
No. In fact, I was thinking about this during your tier discussion, and I think Aloro is like a tier 3 commander.
Yeah, the colors, you could argue that Esper is like a tier 1 shard.
Yeah.
But and Aloro is a very good stuff commander, but that's a whole different rabbit hole of a conversation.
Right.
We should do an episode on good stuff decks. Why they're...
Well, he's not even good stuff, he's life gain.
I think he's good stuff as well.
He could be, because he gives you a nice cushion, but... I mean, if you really want to make an Aloro deck, again, here's like if you want to make an effective but not necessarily cutthroat Aloro deck, one that kind of evolves over time and blossoms into something deadly by turn 8 or 9, you make it a life gain deck and you turn all your life into yada, 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 Ailey.
Hey.
Or Karlov.
Yeah.
They're both vicious in the right hands.
So can, what's his face, Cumball be in the right deck as well? In fact, on EDH Rec the other day, there was an article about a Cumball Taxes deck that was just a nasty piece of work. The article was good. The deck was nasty. There we go. I think to summarize about power level, I think the reason Wizards have never done a quantifiable scale of power for their cards is that it's too subjective. And actually, power level is just perception of power. One person's tier one commander is another person's piece of trash.
Yeah.
Trash. My Marin deck does not have a Spore Frog in it.
What? Are you mad, nope. Sir?
It's not a shaman.
Okay, so I think we've discussed a lot of these topics. So I think the social contract as well, I'll quickly go over this. The golden rule of a paper meta, I find, is to create a social contract that you all feel happy to play. This includes house rules, who's going to be bringing the pizza and giving lifts home, and generally just being good friends to one another. Also, ban Blood Moon. The social contract is spoken about but never really defined. Sorry, I'll start that sentence again. The social contract is the often spoken about but never defined aspect that is unique to Commander as a format. The other formats don't really have that at all. And it's one that people that don't like Commander use to beat Commander, say, oh, it's just like some social multiplayer whiff-waff thing. Do you know what I mean? Sorry to use English.
Whiff-waff, that's great.
It's quoting an awful British politician there. So my personal definition of the social contract is a set of behaviours and rules that you apply to yourself. And that is a set of behavior rules that you would like to be treated yourself when playing Magic, both the game and socially playing the game. So the rules and socially. How, basically, to quote the Bible, which is a small book you may have heard, do unto others as thou would like to be treated yourself. I'm paraphrasing, of course.
No, that was original Deuteronomy 17:2.
I translated it from the ancient Greek.
Yeah.
Nate, you had a slightly different definition of the social contract.
Yeah, I would say try to make sure everyone at the table has fun. Because if you alienate an opponent from playing the game with you, you will ultimately have fewer opponents from which to choose. And then you will be a lonely, bitter, big fish in your tiny, self-shrinking pond.
Phil, you've not written one down, but do you have a pithy definition of a personal definition of the social contract?
Let's just call it Whedon's Law.
As in Joss Whedon?
As in Will Wheaton.
Oh, Wheaton's Law. Okay.
Yes, that was my New York tea coming out.
Hey, yeah, Will Wheaton. Yeah, it's a bit like the London tea.
Yeah, just get along with everybody. Like, don't build a deck and play a deck in a way that ensures that no one has fun. And if you are going to do that, you sort of have a responsibility to make sure that that deck, when it goes off, is at least entertaining to everybody at the table. Right? Everybody's there to have fun, not just you. Play that way.
Yeah, I 100% agree. So I think to summarize the social contract for me, if there's problems in your paper meta and it's all falling apart and you can't seem to resolve them, the practice I like to use for myself is that it's self-reflection. It's the best tool you can have here. What is it that's causing you such a problem? Is there a behavior that you can change in yourself that will reconcile that problem? And then another thing, if there's like a problem player, he's always bringing like 100% decks when we're all playing this. Well, ask yourself, is it the whole paper meta, the whole group that has an issue with that? Or is it actually just yourself? Do you need to adjust your behavior before mm-hmm. you start imposing what you think is how people should behave on others? And then if you do have someone in your paper group who, or a situation in your paper group which is destroying it and it can't be resolved, perhaps look for finding a different paper meta, ultimately. And make sure everyone's having fun. Easier said than done. But, you know. Fun is hard to define, isn't it? What's fun for me is totally different fun for you, Phil, which... And we know Nate is only having fun when our libraries are being put into exile, so...
Yes, when all of our card options are evaporating before our very eyes, as the cards are ripped from our fingers and sometimes removed from their sleeves and thrown across the room, only then, only then is Nate happy. I'm happiest when I have big creatures stomping across the battlefield, sometimes... destroying other people's lands and other resources and leaving behind baby elephants like little gray trunked turds.
And I think you all know when I'm happiest.
Yes, when you're stealing everybody's things.
Or cloning it. Or I've discovered lately is I'm actually happiest when I look like I'm about to lose and I'm actually set up a beautiful win that no one saw coming. Yes, yes, good. And I love killing people. I'm happiest when I'm killing everyone with Urborg and Karma. Anyway, I was going to talk about house rules, but they're fairly straightforward. They're just rules specific to your individualized meta. The key to them, I find, is being flexible with them. If you're too draconian with house rules, and if someone says, oh, I want to try it without that house rule too, it's like, yeah, do it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
If you're too draconian... then you can be creating a problem when there's no need to.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. You want to create a set of house rules that capture the spirit of the type of gameplay you want without really stifling the creativity and energy that goes into deck building and all of the other psychographics at the table, right? Like, I'm a Timmy, not a Johnny, and so I'm sort of predisposed against combos, especially because of my, you know, enforced Johnny phase. which is why, like, you know, I do my best wherever I go to try to limit infinite combos, even though I pulled one off and feel dirty.
Uh-huh.
On Tuesday.
You are playing with Brea, if it's the group meta I think you're talking about.
No. As an aside, that'll probably end up in post-roll. And I'll do it very quickly. I drew on turn... I started my hand with Pili Pala. And I was playing... Talrand. I hate him. I started with Pili Pala, and I was like, oh, wow, Pili Pala. And, you know, so I'm like, oh, this will be kind of fun. And so I wait until, like, turn 5 or 6, and then I put Pili Pala down. And I'm like, oh wow, I wonder if I will draw Grand Architect, right? And so I'm looking at my hand, I'm kind of shuffling my cards, and then I look again and I'm like, that's Grand Architect.
It's already in my hand.
I've been holding Grand Architect and Pili Pala from the beginning of the game. And I'm like, well, I've never done this before. So I put him down and I strapped, I took the greaves off of Dr. Talrand and I put it on the Grand Architect and I just said, go. It was dirty.
Adios. See you later, fellas.
Yeah, it was basically, I put one blue mana in and then I cast whatever I wanted. And it just, I did that and my opponent had no chance. I just had infinite mana. I could do whatever I wanted. I'm going to pull those cards out because I just can't do that again.
I've done this. I don't know if you've ever done it. I've held the infinite combo and just revealed it to the table and said, I have a win con, but I'm enjoying this game, so let's continue playing, or unless anyone desperately wants it to end. And we've...
Yeah, it's... I mean, that's kind of what you do. It's like you hold it there and you're like, hey, do we want this game to end? And not all infinite combos do that. Like when I played the two, I was like, yeah, I can make as much mana as I want. And my opponent was like, yeah, that's kind of bad, but it's not as bad as it could be, which would be like infinitely just kill the guy with Brea. And I still felt bad about it. I just didn't like it actually, by having that infinite combo available, it just... It ruined the game for me. I was like, oh, I have no constraints anymore. I can just do whatever I want. Best was when I get Leyline of Anticipation out, and then the very next card I draw is Vedalken Orreri. So when he removed Leyline, I put Vedalken Orreri down in its place, and it's like, yeah, there you go.
Interesting pronunciation of Orreri. Anyway... so to round this off, remember, nearly all of what we've discussed does not apply to an LGS pickup game. Or any game where you're not playing against regular opponents. You can't control other people's behaviors. You can only control your own. And remember, try and have fun. And try and remember other people have different definitions of fun before you get cross yourself.
Yes.
And it will be more harmonious. But if you're at the LGS, yeah, kill them all. Kill them all if you want that reputation.
Kill them all. Get them, Rocky.
So, it's almost the end of the show, and that means we have a message from Nate.
So, I'm not going to talk about a card. I'm just going to say a philosophy. As Josh Lee Kwai would say, don't call people bags. Don't call them jerks. Yeah, if they combo out with Leyvold and nobody draws cards, don't disparage the people. Because, as I said before, with my definition of the social contract, alienating your opponents leads to a lonely road for yourself, and it could diminish the player base for the entire game.
Yes.
So, as Lord Havelock Vetinari might say, instead of fighting for a bigger slice of the cake, try enlarging the cake.
It's good advice.
Nate, your message of unity is frightening me.
Friendship.
This is not the same Nate that recommended we play Marilyn against new players.
I didn't recommend it. I just said it could happen.
I saw someone play Marilyn as the commander recently, and not one, but three players instantly tutored up their Obnixiluses.
That's great.
The game ended fast.
Yeah.
Good fun. So, everyone, thank you for hanging out with us today. With your support, without your support, this episode could not have happened. And if you want to support the podcast, head over to patreon.com/commander.
That's an interesting pronunciation of podcast.
Yeah, podcast. If you want to support the podcast, head over to patreon.com. And I'll stop swapping O's for A's now. /CommanderAndMTG. And don't forget to give us a 5-star review on iTunes. We love talking to our listeners. And we're incredibly grateful to our patrons like Travis Upton, Richard Rubel, Marcus Ogier, and GoFundMe. Like the GoFundMe people, like Ryan, who I played with the other day, he GoFundMed me.
All right.
Yeah, there's lots of. I'm going to do a special like video or something for everyone who GoFundMed me. Anyway, come play test with us, and if you donate $10 or more per episode, you can come join us in our Patreon chat we host over on Facebook. And you can reach us all by going to commanderandmtg.com. Our email is cast@commanderandmtg.com. And you can find us on all the social medias at, you guessed it, Commander and MTG Podcast. Individually on Twitter, I'm at Copain26.
I'm at Mr. Plorg.
And I'm at Ketjack.
And Nate, in the style of the Spirit of Unity, could you please take us out?
Ooh, that's our show. Be friends.
Commander. Oh, in the interest of the spirit of unity, everyone but the French.
I'm so creeped out by that.
It's about the size of Texas.